This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, John Ehrenberg, fresh from the American Political Science Association conference in Toronto, joins us.
Let's hear what Marx has to say about the current healthcare debate and other economic situations currently in the United States.
We'll hear a first-hand account of the making of William Kunstler disturbing the universe.
If you want to be inspired, if you want to cry, if you want to remember what struggle was like, see this film, William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe.
Stay with us.
Heidi, we were together last week in Foley Square when Lynn Stewart bravely faced the music, had a press conference, and talked about the upholding of her conviction and her imminent imprisonment.
It was sobering news for all of us who know Lynn and who have been following her case, which we consider a symbolic case aimed at demonizing defense attorneys who represent unpopular clients. And as our listeners will recall, Lynn had been sentenced by Judge Kodal in federal court to basically a 2-year sentence, but was out pending appeal. And so what happened last week was the federal appeals court upheld Lynn's conviction. Lynn is 70 years old. She's a cancer survivor. She's scheduled to have surgery in early December. And last week, she turned herself into federal marshals.
It's not only a personal tragedy where they took away this really fine defender of people who otherwise wouldn't get really fine defense counsel. In fact, the judge even noted that in his sentencing. But it's fundamental political loss for all of us who believe in the rights of defendants to have an attorney. Because what the government did here was that they had a television camera and a tape recorder in the cell of her attorney. They tape recorded everything she said. They filmed it. They raided her office. They took all her files. And this has now become de rigueur for the government.
You had mentioned, as we were talking before, Michael, the fact that Lynn also mentioned at the press conference, the events in question, her release of a press release, essentially, on behalf of her client, the Sheikh Abdelrahman, had happened under the Reno tenure, under President Bill Clinton. And that administration gave her basically a slap on the wrist, said, don't do it again. It wasn't until John Ashcroft came in under Bush.
And after 9/11.
Of course, after 9/11, that the government went after her, lost on its first indictment, and then came back with a superseding indictment. They just couldn't let this case go. They had to make a symbol of her.
They made an example out of her. They changed the rules. It was Alice in Wonderland. In the old days, they came up with these special administrative rules, which essentially said to the attorney, you can't tell the outside world what your client says, and to the attorney, you can't tell your client what's going on in the outside world. Lynn broke that rule, but they didn't do anything to her because they didn't do anything to people who broke that rule in those days. They just told her, sign it, sign the agreement again and don't do it again. Clinton didn't do anything. Bush didn't do anything. But after 9/11, Ashcroft went on the David Letterman show, and that's when they started demonizing her. And last week, they put the nail in the coffin and sent her to prison.
The 3-judge panel that issued this decision has essentially sent it back to Judge Kodal to relook at the factors that went into the sentencing. And they're hoping, of course, for a much longer sentence. Judge Kodal had taken into consideration the hundreds of favorable letters written by former clients, by attorneys who'd worked with Lynn, by civil liberties organizations, and come up with the formula for his sentence. The government wanted 30 years. He gave a little over 2. Now the government wants Judge Kodal to look at other factors, including whether Lynn had lied under oath at her trial. We'll see, I guess, what Judge Kodal does. I hope he does the right thing.
Yeah, they're telling Kodal she may have misrepresented the truth about her understanding of this SAMS order.
The special administrative measures.
Exactly. And they're also telling Kodal it's worse because she's an attorney. So you got to look at those 2 factors. And they're nudging him to give her even more time. When you go to prison as a cancer survivor, when you're 70 years old, under that kind of stress, how much time do they want to give her? It's an indication of really the cruelty of this system and the upper levels of the rulers who are personified by the people who sit in the Circuit Court of Appeals. Remember, this was the same court which we talked about 2 weeks ago that made legal rendition to torture. When they refused to give Arar, an outlet in the American courts, they told the government, you got the green light to send people overseas to torture. So the same court that did that is doing this to Lynn Stewart.
Lynn's lawyer, Josh Drittel, has said that the case will be pursued as long as it can, including seeking possible Supreme Court review. We know that Lynn's spirits were high last week. She was of course sad, but determined. She had her books and her personal effects ready to go with her. And we know that she has a very strong and dedicated movement of people who will continue keeping her message and the story of this unjust conviction in the public eye.
Professor John Ehrenberg, the chair of the Political Science Department at Long Island University, has just returned from the American Political Science Association conference in Toronto. Today we have a wide-ranging talk with John Ehrenberg on the situation this country faces and where it's going over the arch of history in the last 50 years. John Ehrenberg, welcome back to Law and Disorder. We love having you on the show.
I love being here.
John, I understand you were recently at the American Political Science Association convention. I used to be an American political scientist. That was my major. Fortunately, I didn't go to graduate school. What was happening there? It must have been interesting.
Well, look, it's an association of professional political scientists. So mostly what they're involved with is building models and trying to act like they're economists. But there are these moments at the APSA that are kind of interesting. And I was on a panel that talked about Marxism and the current crisis. What, if anything, does Marx have to offer?
So there you go. It's cool. Question of the day. So tell us.
Yeah.
Marxism, anything to offer?
There's much more interest in Marx now than there used to be.
Right. We do know
that. Das Kapital was the bestseller in East Germany 2 months ago.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There was that article in the paper about that. That's right. And there are more courses being offered, and there are books coming out and stuff like that. So people are more interested in what the old
man has to say. So tell us, why should we be interested, and what was the panel like?
I'll tell you what my little piece of the panel was. Right. And it was mostly in terms of what does Marx have to offer us today, if anything. And I was talking about Marx's political journalism from the 1840s when he's talking about France and he's doing the Civil War in France. Well, that's later. He's talking about the class struggles in France and he's observing this crisis during the French revolutions of 1848 to 1851. He's describing this moment in French history when the objective needs of the system were incapable of being addressed or realized by a dysfunctional political apparatus that was unable to respond. So he tries to kind of chart out how this played out in the events in France. And it occurred to me—
How a dysfunctional political system
was
unable to deal with the objective,
needs.
And so he charted how that occurred.
How that played itself out.
Of course, you're immediately going to go to where we are today, right?
Of course.
So go there.
So I was thinking, well, what does that have to do with today, right? And it occurred to me, here you have, in the healthcare debate, here you have this really, really interesting moment where the stranglehold of finance capital, and in particular the stranglehold of the insurance companies, but behind the insurance companies, it's Wall Street, has created this situation with regard to healthcare where the president of the United States says repeatedly that unless this problem is dealt with, it's going to bankrupt the state. Governors of states say the same thing. Mayors of cities say the same thing. So throughout the political system, the fiscal crisis of the state has taken the form of this blackmail on the part of the insurance industry about healthcare premiums.
So let's put it into what you said. Objective factors are just what you said.
Are just what they are, right?
And the government has been—
Well, it's worse than that. Not only are political spokesmen saying this, but you get the same thing coming from the industrialists. When people talk about the collapse of American auto, one of the major drivers for the collapse of American auto is the costs of healthcare. So you have this, and more, GE is saying this thing, more and more people from both the industrial wing, if you want, of the bourgeoisie and of the political leadership are saying this has absolutely got to be changed. It's got to be.
I'm just going to ask you an aside question, and then I want to go back to the main theme. When you mention GE or you mention the auto companies, why, when they knew that this was happening with the healthcare, was really beginning to eat into any kind of money they had because the number of workers was getting fewer and fewer. The healthcare people they had to support was greater and greater.
Right.
Why didn't they ever come out for a public healthcare system? Why didn't they have the government pay for it?
Yeah, good. It's a really
you know, like they question. Like they do in Germany where they make Audis and BMWs and Mercedes, or like they do in Sweden where they make Saabs, and they never did it here. It was their contribution.
Was it just ideology? Is the best I can think.
And yeah. A lot of it is also the history of American healthcare. The deal that was made at the end of World War II was that you would go to an employer-based system, and in return for which the government would give the companies all kinds of tax write-offs for the premiums they paid. But at that point, the benefits were given in lieu of pay increases, and the industrialists figured it was worth it. And in some respects, it was
that
worth
makes
it.
Sense. Okay, back to your main theme here. You were describing our objective conditions
okay,
now.
Okay, so back
the,
to the main
the healthcare
so,
debate.
So you've got the situation where you've got a fairly narrow section of finance capital insisting on the maintenance of a system that is objectively contrary to the needs of other sectors of the economy and of the political apparatus as well. You would think then that if the state is the executive committee of the ruling class, right, you would think that the political machinery would start to work and some kind of rational system would be imposed, and yet it can't. And so we have this moment. It's just fascinating historically. We have this moment in American history that I think in some superficial ways is not unlike that of France, where the political apparatus is so dysfunctional and is so paralyzed and it is so beholden to a particular very small set of so-called special interests that it cannot move forward on a solution to a system which is objectively threatening the integrity of the entire apparatus. And that's, I think, the moment that we're in. So just as kind of a social scientist, quite apart from a participant in this, as a social scientist, it's really this – I think there's much more at stake here than a public option or single payer for all or Olympia Snow or Max Baucus or however this thing plays out. You've got a political system which is paralyzed and dysfunctional and unable to move forward, and this is only – the first of several instances of this that are coming down the road.
I totally agree with you, John. I think it's really a brilliant insight to explain it the way you have, because the government is, in essence, the executive committee of all the really powerful ruling elites, and they can't get out of the hole they've dug for themselves. I think part of the reason is that they've got a two-party system, really a one-party system with a left wing and a right wing, or two right wings, and there's no way for people down below to assert any pressure on it because money talks in Congress, and we don't have a parliamentary system, so we don't have different interests represented. We really only have their interest representative, and I think that's part of the logjam.
That is, I said before that there were superficial similarities to France when Marx was writing, and they are superficial in the sense that what was in play in France was a very vibrant democratic, republican, socialist, anarchist series of movements that were out in the streets, and they really drove the process forward. We don't have that. And part of the issue, you guys ought to know this as lawyers. Another piece of this is a structural characteristic of the American political system. This system was consciously designed to allow private interests to penetrate the political apparatus. Daniel Lazar has written about this in his great book about the Constitution. A lot of political scientists too have talked about this, that the way this system is structured, the way American federalism is set up, it's much more difficult to get anything done, particularly anything comprehensive, than it is to block reform. The history of the country is full of failed efforts to pass comprehensive legislation of all sorts because the system is so easily penetrated, it's so fractured, it's so decentralized. And so what that makes it possible is it makes it possible for the state or pieces of the state to be almost directly colonized by these private interests. So there is this other piece of it that's, I think, peculiarly American and has to do with the nature of this constitutional system under which we live.
You mentioned – we've talked about the healthcare issue with these objective circumstances and what the dysfunctional government is unable to do, and worse than dysfunctional, as you've said, even perpetrating some of the worst of the objective circumstances. You said there were some other examples coming down the road. You want to talk about some of those?
Yeah. I mean all the – look, you've got Obama who was elected rhetorically with very, very big plans. And this is a guy who I think in some levels really does want to do – things on a large scale. He wants to have – whether it's climate change legislation or – there's all kinds of big plans this guy has. And you can already see them being picked apart. You can already see the lobbyists picking this piece of it out, that piece of it out, changing this piece, modifying that piece. I think that you've got this – you know, unlike FDR, who came into office as a tinkerer, as an eclectic kind of let's see what we can do. Obama came into office almost self-consciously as a reformer on a system-wide basis. And I think we're likely to see the same process at work. It's more than the role of the Republican Party. There's something much deeper. I mean, the Republican Party has become this shrunken rump, right? Of a Southern-based, white, male, Christian. And they were all marginalized at the last election. The polling data notwithstanding, and Marx also talks about this, you know, how elections are at best a gauge of the mood of the population. They don't settle anything. This election was a gauge of the mood of the electorate at that moment. And all the public opinion data indicates that, well, the electorate is still in the same basic frame of mind as it was a year ago at this time. Nevertheless, you have a situation where 65% of the people of the country, when polled, say that they are for a public option, and we ain't going to get it. Or if we get it, it's going to be some bastardized shadow of it. So elections don't settle the thing. What happens is our political leaders and our political coalitions able to put comprehensive programs together after big-time elections like this last one. And, you know, we'll see what this guy's made of, but I'm not sure in thinking about the Obama administration's failures up until now, or lack of success, put it that way, I'm not sure how much is on his shoulders, how much of it's structural, how much of it's historic at this particular historic juncture. But whatever it is, I think we're at a really, really interesting moment.
Yeah, I do too, John. I think that the way out of the trap, and I think that this won't be done, but the way out of it would be for Obama to go over the heads of the finance capital that supported him, Goldman Sachs, everybody from Greenwich, Connecticut. That was the majority of his support, just as they supported Clinton, and just as they're now mainly Democrats, not Republicans. He has to go over the heads of these elites that supported him to the population and mobilize the population. And my prediction is that will not happen because that's dangerous to get those people. You give them health care for everybody. You give them Medicare for everybody. Then they're going to want education for everybody. Then they're going to want a guaranteed job for everybody at union wages. You know, then they're going to want decent housing. You know, then they're going to, and it's on and on. And they don't want that process to start. And they're not going to mobilize. I think if that process starts, it has to start from the bottom up, not from the top down.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, I just saw Michael Moore's movie.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. And at the end of it, it gets really, really good. I mean, it's a good movie, but it gets really, really strong toward the end. And what he does at the end is he starts talking about FDR's second Bill of Rights, the Bill of Social Rights that FDR wanted to promulgate a year before he died. And they're all the social rights that you were talking about, right to an education, right to a job, right to decent health care, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Ironically, it turns out, and Moore, this is one of Moore's, one of these wonderful little things that he does in his movies. He says that what the United States was unwilling to do at home, it insisted upon when it rewrote the constitutions of the Axis. And it was perfectly content to sit around and watch the Europeans write into law all the basic rights-based structures of the modern welfare state, but it wouldn't do it at home. In Europe, you had institutions that could mobilize people. We don't here. In Europe, you had, at the end of the war, you had vibrant communist parties, you had vibrant socialist parties, you had powerful trade unions. They were the ones who really led the fight. We are in this terrible situation.
We did have those when Roosevelt got elected.
That's right.
I mean, if you look at it, it was labor and the communist parties and the socialist parties that actually pushed him.
Well, that's
and we don't have them anymore.
That's a good point, Michael. I think you could pinpoint the beginning and the end when what we had, as Michael pointed out, they took away. I think starting in 1949 when they drove the radicals out of the trade union movement, started the McCarthyite witch hunt, kept them out. I think the student radicalization that we were all part of in the 60s was a blip. In retrospective, you know, historically, it was a blip, and they crushed those unions after they got the radicals out. Auto, steel, rubber, all those major CIO unions are just a shadow now. And I think because of that, we don't have any kind of leverage to get the kind of social rights that everybody wants.
That's right. We look to Obama to mobilize us, and he's not going to do it.
The intriguing thing you said that, you know, a lot of us or a lot of people out there blame the Republican right for being hard-nosed, not giving them any votes in the Senate. But what you're saying is really something more institutional going on, not just with the Republicans, with the Democrats, and with the whole way the country is structured.
Yeah, I do think that's what's going on. It's easy to look at the present moment and look at the gridlock. But you've got this situation. I mean, some of my friends say, well, look, the problem is not structural this way. The country really is deeply divided. And given that, there's very little Obama can do. I don't buy it. I mean, every opinion poll we've had shows that people really want. They want climate change legislation. They want this cap and trade stuff. They want the public option. Why is it that when you get a wide consensus of the population that has been durable, it has been stay over the last year, this 65% of the population who – it goes up and down. It was down a little bit after the Tea Party episodes of the summer, but basically it's been pretty stable. How is it that an overwhelming sentiment of the population does not get translated into the political system? And that – when you come to that point, you've got a real structural crisis. And that's what a lot of people actually – a lot of straight – political scientists, they were a little worried. They were talking about that in Toronto from a different perspective from mine. But there is this growing sense that the official structures of the state are increasingly unresponsive and both unresponsive and incapable. There's another sense of this. So let me bring this third thing that we're talking about in Toronto. Why is this, right? Why is it that the situation is so polarized and the paralysis is so deep? And here's where official political science has really done some interesting work. Political scientists have a way of charting the levels of political polarization. I think there's a consensus in the profession that political polarization is in almost direct relationship to levels of economic inequality. The more unequal the distribution of wealth in society as a whole, the more polarized and the more dysfunctional, except for these moments of exception, the more polarized and the more dysfunctional the political apparatus becomes. And what we've been seeing over the last 30 years, ever since Reagan, is a conscious transfer of enormous amounts of wealth from the productive classes in society to the appropriating classes in society. And along with that has come this heightened level of tension, of polarization, of refusal to cooperate. So you got a guy like Paul Krugman, who talks about, you know, the golden age of American capitalism, the period, like you say, Michael, a period that begins in 1949 and goes through our youth. It goes through the middle 1960s. This is when the distribution of wealth was more egalitarian than it had been since the 1870s and 1880s. It's where the institutions that we talk about as being so essential to public health and the equitable distribution of resources are in place. You've got powerful trade unions. You've got a vibrant Democratic Party, et cetera. And you've also got a remarkable period of, quote unquote, bipartisan politics, because the political structure of the country was such that Krugman tends to idolize this and idealize it and not talk very much about male supremacy. He doesn't talk all that much about blacks in the South. But there is this moment when there's a wide range of cooperation from a broadly left of center perspective to a broadly right of center perspective, but they're able to get things done, is what he says. Since 1980, Congress can't get anything done. It's never gotten anything important done since this maldistribution of wealth really began. So perhaps the last element in the story, and you know, somebody needs to write this up and really do some investigation about it. But when you look at the why, about, you know, why is the system so paralyzed and dysfunctional and unable to move forward? Why is Obama's bipartisanship so obviously such a pipe dream? I think you have to relate it to 30 years of policies that serve wealth and that serve privilege and served inequality.
At this point, I think the country has the greatest disequilibrium in wealth since the 1920s, or almost equal to the 1920s, and of any Western wealthy country.
That's right. We are the most unequal, advanced country on the planet.
Even if Obama was a stronger, cleverer, whatever else, it's not clear that the executive power, the institutional state that has taken over from war, from hegemony, empire, et cetera, since the end of the Second World War, increasing dramatically under Reagan, that can be shifted very much, if at all.
And it may be that it doesn't matter what the president has to say. It doesn't matter what the president believes. What Will ends up saying is that there is this deep structure of the state.
Right.
And sooner or later, the imperatives that it imposes on elected political leaders simply cannot be avoided.
The question, and I was reading, you probably know the book, it's called Revolutionary Horizons by Forrest Hilton.
I know of it. I haven't read it.
It's about Bolivia and Morales. And it opens with an opening by a guy named Adolfo Gili. And it opens by saying, okay, Morales is elected, and within the context of Bolivia, how elastic or inelastic are the structures of the state that will allow him to move in certain directions? And the question you have about Obama, which I still have, is how much is it his fault How much could he be pushing it to at least the edges of what's elastic by doing what Michael's saying, you know, going out on the stump, saying really, really appealing to the 65% who want the public option? And how much is he just being confined in another way because of his own limitations? I don't know the answer to that.
We're going to find out soon enough. Yeah. This is also an important moment for gauging Obama and his presidency to see, you know, part of there was this very interesting article that Matt Bai wrote about 6 months ago in the Times Magazine section. And I think Matt Bai is a pretty smart political reporter. He said, now, you know, this is only his analysis of it, but he said that the Obama strategy around health care is fairly clearly set out. They studied the failure of the Clinton plan, and they concluded that one of the reasons why Hillary's plan failed is because she didn't involve the Congress. She did this very secretively. Hillary concluded, what I said a few minutes ago, Hillary concluded that the Congress was the plaything of special interests and the plaything of parochial concerns, so it couldn't be trusted. So she would craft this comprehensive, broad plan and then basically ram it down Congress's throat. And it didn't work. And even the Democrats in Congress refused to deal with her on that basis. So the Obama people on this read took their lesson from Hillary's failure and decided instead to defer to Congress. They'd let Congress do it. And supposedly, they knew that Congress sooner or later would get all tied up in knots, at which point Obama would come in at the 11th hour and impose a deal. Now, maybe that's what's going to happen. Maybe he's going to sit down. He's got five different bills. It's just total chaos in terms of where Congress is at right now. Maybe at some decisive point in the next month or two, he's going to come in, you know, on the horse with the two guns out, and he's just going to sit down and knock heads together, and we're going to get something. I think that is his end game. Whether it's going to work or not, whether he's got the gumption for it, whether he's got the analysis and the clarity of vision, like, we're all going to see this in the next few months. It doesn't change the basic problem, I think, though. Even if Obama can pull something off at the last minute about this particular issue, the historical and political and economic and structural issues remain the same.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold my breath about any kind of decent health care thing coming up. I think we have to go back to the function of the government, which is in main part to run an empire. They have 700 and some bases and 100 and some countries around the world. Half the treasury every year goes to the maintenance of that empire. And you have to start there. And I think as a consequence, we've seen since we were teenagers a steady decline in every indicator in this country. Health, education, science, life expectancy. The place is degenerating. And we've lived long enough to see really degenerate before our eyes.
Yeah. And, you know, this is where if you pursue this line of reasoning, you want to throw your hands up in the air in despair. Because the real thing that Marx talks about when he talks about this is what he means when he begins to talk about the dictatorship of the proletariat. When he says in the manifesto, he says the very first act of the workers on seizing power is to break up the old state apparatus and build a new one. And we all know the example of Allende. And we know that unless these deep constitutional and state structures are dismantled and replaced with forms that are more appropriate to a different form of power, all the imperatives we've been talking about are going to reassert themselves. Now, that's not on the table. It's not anywhere near on the table. So all we're left with is what we have. And we're left with the Democratic Party and a Democratic president and a wonderful, wonderful Olympia Snow voted for the bill. That this is what we got. So yeah. I don't know where to go with this any more than you guys do.
Let me ask you a question going back to when we had you on the show earlier. We had talked about the difference between Obama and McCain, and you said, well, I think I would want to see Obama because I think he will do more of a Keynesian solution to the economic crisis and really essentially saying pump more money in to the economy. You didn't specify whether to the banks or to the jobs. But I'm interested in your perspective on you predicted that. Has it been what you expected? Has it been less than you expected? Certainly it's been better than McCain, I assume. But let me hear you.
Yeah, what your thoughts are. It's better than McCain would have done. But is it? I mean, the money he shoved at the banks, and there are a lot of supports for private spending out there as well. I mean, there's, you know, the extension of unemployment benefits, and they're going to increase the minimum wage and stuff like that. But here again, you're Obama. You take office in January. The entire financial structure is wobbling, and you conclude that the only thing you can do is shovel $700 billion of public money at the people who created the problem in the first place. So we all stood by appalled as he had, as he appointed Larry Summers and Geithner and all these guys, and as he basically did what Wall Street demanded. But then you have the, well, suppose he hadn't. It's the what-if question. Suppose he had said, you people caused the problem in the first place. I'm going to go out and do something different. What do you do? I mean, I really do think that the limits within which people operate are much more important than we thought when we were young.
I mean, I would agree with that, actually. I think that's right. But when you say that, what would he have done? Couldn't he have done both? Couldn't he have created a real jobs program? Not just, let's say, shovel. Okay, he's going to shovel the money to the banks because whatever the limits are and he wants them off the, whatever.
Yeah.
He thinks that's necessary. But he also could have created a real job program.
Well, suppose he claims that the stimulus program, you know, these shovel-ready programs and blah, 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 that as right. the money works its way through the system, it will create more jobs. It hasn't happened. And right. we're inching toward 10% unemployment. And all the economists are saying we're in this for another few years anyway. Economic forecasters for the city are talking about 5 years of slack job growth. This, we're talking about Japan's lost decade. No. Has he done what I would have wanted FDR to do in this circumstance? No. That's because he's not FDR.
There's some theories on that. One is that FDR came from the ruling class and didn't mind dealing with them and told them in the end, look, I saved you guys. Whereas Obama came up, mother eventually became vice president of a bank. He went to an elite high school in Hawaii, then went to elite college and elite law school, and is now one of the elites and is, you know, doing what the elite would like him to do, and hasn't done anything near as radical as FDR.
Let me talk to you a little bit about the national security issues, or the so-called national security issues, and get your perspective on Obama getting the Peace Prize. As we've said, there's limits to maybe what he can do, but of course, we're seeing an increase in Afghanistan, most likely. We saw a terrible response on the Goldstone report in Gaza. So I'd just be interested in your thoughts about it and where that fits into your analysis.
Yeah, here too. I mean, here too, Obama turns out to be less than we had all hoped. I think the Nobel Peace Prize was given to push him along. I mean, I think the committee was fairly clear about that. And that's happened before. And Rachel Maddow had this little rap on her show saying that the Nobel Peace Prize is often given not for things you've accomplished, but for things, directions that the committee wants to push you in. Okay, so what kind of direction? Well, he's got Afghanistan, and you've got – and I do think that in large measure the buildup in Afghanistan is designed to give him cover for the withdrawal from Iraq. I mean, politically, I think that's part of what's going on. Is he going to rethink the strategy in Afghanistan? Is he going to pull back? Who knows? But here again, you have the Gary Wills question that you were talking about before, Michael. I think the Nobel Peace Prize was given not so much to Obama. I think it actually was given to the American voter. I think that's really what they wanted to say. And I think what they wanted to say was that after 8 years of this monstrous administration that preceded Obama, I still can't say the guy's name.
I'll say it. It's Bush.
Yeah.
Or Cheney.
after these 8 years, a turn toward multilateralism, a turn toward the UN, all the things we've been talking about, is so welcomed and so important and so fundamental in the Nobel's Committee for the Peace of the World that they were prepared to just give the prize and just say, keep on going on. Does it mean much more than that? I really don't think
so. No, I mean, I think that's right. I think they saw 8 terrible years in which you had an iron hand of a hegemony rather than a velvet hand. They like the fact that they're going back to the velvet hand.
Yeah.
I think I would.
And we all do.
John, when Khrushchev received the Lenin Peace Prize, JFK, who had his wits about him, said, he quipped, I hope he keeps it. And I agree with you. I think that Obama was given the Nobel Prize on the hopes that he earns it.
I think what John was saying was giving it in some way to the American people. And when you think about the headline of the Daily Mail in the second election of Bush, when it said, how could 55 million people be so stupid, which is to vote for Bush, what the committee is saying is Americans were glad you decided to get rid of Bush and the politics of Bush and actually open up at least an era of some diplomacy.
It shows you how bad things were.
Yeah, but let me tell you what I think the danger is. That now, armed with the mantle of the Nobel Peace Prize, he then goes and escalates to whatever extent the war in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And it's a very dangerous moment. And to give the head of the American Empire the Nobel Peace Prize really disarms irony. I mean, I thought it was an article in The Onion when I first
read it. All my friends. They thought that the website of the New York Times had been hacked.
Yes.
Today I had to write something on, you know, on the U.S. presenting the Goldstone Report. Not the U.S., but the Goldstone Report being presented to the National, to the Security Council. And, of course, the U.S. has been terrible. Here's the most eminent jurist in the world. And not only did Obama say nothing about Gaza, but now they've actually attacked Goldstone's report. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty shocking stuff.
Yeah.
you said a few moments ago and threw up your hands, you know, and where do we go from here? I think we have to be thinking of uniting those organizations that do mountaintop removal and do peace work and do free Gaza work and everything else that all of us in the movement do. The problem is that we do it in isolation from everybody else. And we do it locally and not nationally. And I think we have to be thinking of some kind of perspective and some kind of organization. I do ultimately think that because the bad guys are organized, we have to be organized too. And I think that the most sophisticated form of anarchism is that you understand that you have to be organized. I wouldn't call myself an anarchist. I would call myself more of a libertarian socialist. But I do think that we need to ultimately protect ourselves in a kind of organization. And we have to think about how to get from where we are to where we want to be.
You're right. We do have all these parochial organizations. But I'm very gratified to see, and even during the Bush years, the number of interest groups out there, the number of things that are going on, the number of appeals for money, the number of websites that have sprung up, et cetera, really testifies to a very heightened level of political activity. And now we need to think about where we go from there. You're absolutely right. That's the optimist in me.
Well, John, you're always pretty optimistic, I mean, about these things. Even now, you understand the limitations of the structure, but you're generally optimistic.
What did Gramsci say? pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the heart.
And we'll have to see whether Obama can really pull something significant out of healthcare, although I must say whatever his personal issues are, but the drag on him on these issues is very strong.
It really is. And this public option, you know, the White House says from time to time it's not that big a deal. It's not a deal breaker for us. It's really fundamental. Given how backward this country's medical system is and how cruel and arbitrary it is, and given the administration's decision not even to raise the question of Medicare for all and not even to go over the heads of the parties to the population as a whole and organize people, the best we can do is the so-called public option, which is itself pretty weak and is likely to be even more weakened by Schumer and others as we go through the process. But in some form, the public option is, for me, really a bellwether issue.
And let me ask you about that, because I have friends in the healthcare who are advocates who are very good on this issue, on general issue. And they said to me, Michael, look, sure, I might rather have a public option, but it's not really that crucial because we're going to be insuring 27 million more people, which are the uninsured. And the uninsured. So what do you say to that?
Obama has always said that his primary goal is universal coverage, although you're quite right. It's going to cut in half the number of people who are uninsured. But Obama has always said, if I have to trade competition for universality, I'll take the universality.
Exactly.
Well, the fact is he can have both. He really can have both. As strong as public opinion is around the principle of universality, it's even stronger when it comes to the public option. There's no reason why these two imperatives have to be put against each other. There's none, unless you're talking about horse trading and deals that he feels he has to make in Congress. But I object to the terminology. I object to Obama saying it's either one or the other. There's no reason why at this juncture in American history he can't have both.
John Ehrenberg, again, it's great to talk to you always. Check in with you in a couple of months after healthcare.
After healthcare, yeah.
Okay, John, thanks.
Real nice to see you, John. Thanks for being on Law & Disorder.
Pleasure, you guys.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
We are excited to welcome Sarah and Emily Kunstler, daughters of the late radical civil rights attorney William Kunstler, and the directors of a biographical documentary about their father, titled William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe.
The movie has been described as a sensitive, truthful, and insightful film about a man who stood at the center of a confrontational movement and became the public spokesperson for communities standing up to injustices. Emily and Sarah are producers and directors who run the Off-Center Media Production Company. Emily, a film major and former video producer for Democracy Now!, and Sarah, a criminal defense attorney practicing in the Eastern and Southern Districts of New York, recently won the L'Oreal Women of Worth Vision Award at the 2009 Sundance Film Festival and the special jury prize for Best New Filmmakers at the Traverse City Film Festival. Also joining us is Joey Johnson, plaintiff in the landmark Supreme Court case Johnson v. Texas, one of the flag-burning cases that Bill Kunstler defended. Sarah and Emily and Joey, too, welcome so much to Law & Disorder.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
We're thrilled that Disturbing the Universe is in New York right now, being screened as well as around the country, and delighted to hear about how you came to make the film and what happened during the filming as well as the content. How long has this been in the making?
This is Emily speaking. Sarah and I worked on this film for 4 years, but we think about it as if we really started it from our infancy, so really 30 years. You can tell when you see the film that we've been collecting footage and other materials since we were children.
It starts out, the opening scene, with Sarah and Emily as little girls up in the country. The film is like the mystery of who their father was and how did he come to do what he did. Told brilliantly. Emily went to film school and did the editing, I think. And Sarah went to law school and did the writing. And it all comes together. It's just a great collaboration. And Joey Johnson, you figure in the film, too, because you burned the flag, the American flag, and Bill saved you.
Yeah, Bill played a very important role in the whole battle. Texas versus Johnson was my case, a Supreme Court flag-burning case. And I was arrested in 1984 for burning the American flag in Dallas, Texas, when Reagan was being renominated for his second term.
Sarah, it's the driving tension in the film is you're growing up, you're young women living on Gay Street, and the Jewish Defense League is out in front of your home screaming things about your father. Your mother's told you, don't go out, it's dangerous. And you're wondering, what the hell did my father do? How did he get us into this pickle? And you try to figure out the course of your father's political struggle. Pick it up from there, will you?
Well, Emily and I, when we were children, when he was taking those cases, when he was representing El Said Nosair, when he was representing Larry Davis or Yusef Salam, one of the Central Park jogger defendants, We felt that he had a choice, and we didn't understand why he was choosing those cases, that he could have aligned himself with anybody. Why did he want to stand next to people who were accused of such horrible crimes? And it was especially hard for us when it had such a direct impact on our family, when you opened the door and you could hear people screaming, or when you answered the phone and people would say nasty things. You know, we had our front windows were broken with red paint pellets. My dad had bullets sent to him in the mail. It was we just wondered if at what price was he doing this and what was it worth? That was our primary motivation in making this film, was to kind of examine why he made those choices.
Well, talk to us about what kind of political decisions Bill was making early in his career and then later on.
Well, those were our bedtime stories. You know, Bill would sit Sarah and I down at night and tell us about these great heroics in the South and during the Civil Rights Movement and during the anti-war movement. These were, you know, it was like the stuff dreams were made of. He was a comic book hero to us. That's why the contrast was so great between that work and the work that we saw in our lifetime. He didn't have that kind of movement support behind him. He didn't have the support of many of his peers. And he had sort of the waning support of his family. So it was very different. But he felt similarly about the work that he was doing. I don't think he ever thought that he was inconsistent. I think it was the people around him that thought that he was inconsistent. Our father thought that to align himself with the most unpopular people in society, to stand up for people that are vilified by the media and by the government, was important civil rights work. because those were the moments where people's rights were most likely to be violated. He really saw that as a role that he could play.
We're speaking with Sarah Kunstler and Emily Kunstler, whose wonderful film, Disturbing the Universe, about their father, is going to be playing all around the country. One of the cases that he took, I think, which most illustrates your point, Emily, is the case of the Central Park jogger. Tell us the story and what he did there.
Well, Bill ended up defending... Dad ended up defending.
But you always called him, let's be honest.
I know,
Emily.
As kids you we called him Bill. It's actually only through the making of this film have I now learned to call him Dad. But it's confusing
to people. My kids, because of you kids, always called me Michael. And until recently, now they call me Dad. But for years, they only called me Michael because Emily and Sarah called their dad Bill.
Well, everyone else called him Bill. So it seemed to make sense.
Right.
But Dad ended up defending Youssef Salaam during his sentencing and then through the appeals process. Youssef, along with four other young men, was accused of brutally raping a woman in Central Park. And the media attention was insane around that case. They were completely vilified. They were called animals, a wolf pack. There were, you know, ads taken out. Trump took an ad out in the paper calling for the death penalty. I mean, it was really, it sort of polarized the worst of race relations in the city at that time period, that case. So, you know, Bill stood up for Youssef. It was not a popular choice to make.
He got into a dispute with a racist judge and wound up calling the judge a racist, which allowed the judge then to make a complaint to the Bar Association to get Bill disciplined. And Bill came close to getting disbarred. I was at the hearing. I remember it vividly. Turns out that the person that he defended was totally innocent.
Yeah. This is Sarah. He called the judge a disgrace to the bench. You know.
Can you imagine a lawyer today in our current context going before a judge and saying you're a disgrace to the bench? I mean, it would be great, but we don't have that anymore.
Sarah and Emily, both of you are obviously involved in social justice work through your filmmaking and Sarah through your legal work. Was there a defining moment as you were growing up that when you knew you were committed to this kind of work?
This is Sarah. I don't know. My dad was the principal embellisher of his own myth. He would certainly have it. He had many defining moments that took him from one place to another. I think a defining moment for Emily and I was when we went to Tulia, Texas, and we ended up making a documentary about a racist drug bust that took place there in 1999 that netted 20% or over 20% of the African-American population of a small town in the Texas Panhandle. And I think that in making that film and bringing it home with us and sharing the injustice of that situation with the world, that was the moment that Emily and I began to understand the power of documentary film as a tool for social justice. So I don't know, Emily, do you have any other defining moments?
I think that's a pretty good one. You know,
What year was that, Emily, that you went to Tulia?
99.
Tell us about Bill's defining moment as you portray it in the film.
Which one?
Well, when he was down south with the Freedom Riders.
Bill had, as you said earlier, just sort of a general practice doing, you know, wills and estates, who knows what else, on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. And he was a member of the ACLU, and he got a call saying that they needed observers to go down to Mississippi to watch the Freedom Riders get off the bus and sit down at the lunch counter. And he went. He showed up there. He went down to the bus terminal. He watched this group of young people courageously get off this bus and face whatever unknown fate was before them. And he was blown away by their strength and their courage and by their willingness to put themselves on the line for what they believed in. And from that moment, he couldn't turn back. He couldn't just be an armchair liberal anymore. He knew that it was the action that changed things. It wasn't the talking. So that, you know, changed the course of his life.
Question about the title. Where's the title from, and what's it about, Disturb the Universe?
The title comes from the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, which is a T.S. Eliot poem. And in that poem, the protagonist of that poem is struggling with action, whether or not to take action. And he says, do I dare, do I dare? And there's a line, do I dare disturb the universe? Do I dare eat a peach?
Equivalent.
And it's kind of like this to be or not to be moment. You know, do I rise up and do something, or do I just, you know, quietly go about doing kind of normal, ordinary things? And for our father, he was obsessed with that moment. He thought that everyone's life had that moment, or that everyone in life was faced with a series of moments where they would be confronted with that kind of choice, whether or not to stand up and take principled action or to do nothing. And when he spoke to young people, he exhorted them to be prepared for when that moment would come in their lives, to not be afraid, to have the courage to act with conviction. And that was how we decided to title the film, to kind of highlight that moment or that decision.
Well, tell the story about Michelangelo's David and the first time he saw it in Florence.
Emily, why don't you tell that story?
Well, our dad told us when we were growing up about his trip to Europe when he was a teenager, and how he went to see Michelangelo's statue of David, and a man who was looking at the statue with him told him that this was the only depiction of David before he throws the stone at Goliath. All the other depictions have him holding Goliath's head triumphantly or with his foot on Goliath's chest, but this was the only one that showed him still thinking, still making that choice, where he could have easily maybe made another choice. I mean, it's this moment of great thought, and you can really see when you look at that statue that he's grappling with this decision. And Bill loved that story because it reminded him of the choices that we all have in our lives. And he would tell us this story repeatedly. He would tell it to students when he would travel speaking repeatedly, just about that moment, similarly to the poem that he would quote, that it's just this opportunity that we all have in our lives to stand up in the face of injustice. And we can, it's actually a choice that's within our power to do so.
In watching that story, and your dad told me that story a number of times, and I don't know whether it was an embellishment or not, and I think we've talked about this. He always says the man who told him the story while he was standing before the statue of David was a well-known critic named Bernard Berenson, extremely famous during your dad's generation. You didn't put that in the film, and I'm just wondering, was that like the...
We can't verify that one, Michael.
We can't
verify that.
But your dad told the story with Bernard.
That story changed over the years, as all of his stories did. So, Bernard Berenson came in at a certain point and then disappeared again and then came back again. So, but David was always there, so we kept David.
One of the reactions that a lot of my friends have had in seeing screenings of the film was that, really, in some way, you and Sarah and Emily, both of you, have been making this film your whole lives. It opens with the two of you standing on a little piece of grass at a place you had during the summer and interviewing your dad with the end of a water hose and saying, and now the great William Kunstler, and you guys are very little, 5, 6, 7, whatever you are. And then there's other scenes where, Sarah, you are hiding under his desk and tape recording him and you're asking questions or on the phone listening in. And in some way, it seems like even though you've only been making the film, not only, you've been making it for 5 years, there seems to be something about recording your father or your whole lives. And I'm trying to come to an understanding of what that was about.
This is Sarah. I think it had to do with kind of this understanding of our dad's fame or his relationship with the media, that we saw him interact with the world in that way. We saw him go out on the front stoop of our house and hold press conferences. The press conference was a big thing to us growing up. There, we thought about holding press conferences when things happened. We knew there was a list next to the fax machine of all the people you were supposed to send out the releases to. So he was all about the press and about using the press to get a message across. And when we would walk down the street with him, he would get attention. Emily says it took forever to get to school in the morning. We were always late because although it was only four blocks away, we'd get stopped all the way to school. So when you have a father that has that relationship with the media and that public persona, you start to engage him that way. You interview him with a garden hose, you take out a tape recorder and you do an interview because that's part of your dad's life, so you want to be a part of that too.
Sarah and Emily, your film has already won awards and received critical acclaim. What has the response been from individuals who've come up to you and given feedback?
This is Sarah. It's, you know, it was very frightening for us to share our film with the world, to share it with audiences. It's, you know, the first, you know, 10 or 15 times we sat there and, you know, clenched our fists and, you know, couldn't even look. But it's been positive. We've had, it's a really powerful thing sitting in an audience with people watching your film and feeling them react, and audiences kind of react in waves. And when it's your film, you're an observer of the audience. You're not really watching the film. So we sit there kind of feeling the emotional response. Sometimes they respond, sometimes they don't. Sometimes the audience will respond to parts that nobody else has responded to before, and you try to sit there and figure it out, and it can be maddening. Joey knows this too, because he's seen the film 20 or 30 times with us with an audience, and we all sit there saying, why aren't they laughing? People usually laugh here.
Or what's so funny about that moment?
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, we've had a great time. People that come up to us after they see it are going to be people who have good things to say. No one walks up to a director after a film to tell them off, at least not in our experience. So I'm sure there's people that watch it and don't like it and don't have a good time, but those are not the people that interact with us.
I got a note from somebody after the last showing, someone who I expected would like it but not necessarily love it, and who doesn't wear his emotions on his sleeve. And the note said, Michael, this is one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. I expected it more to just be the straight political history, but because it was done from the perspective of Emily and Sarah, it made it much more interesting, and it brought tears to my eyes. And I think that's probably what many of the comments, at least similar to that, are. And I think having the perspective of you two making the film, rather than just a straightforward, this is Wounded Knee, this is Attica, this is Bill, I think that made a huge difference in it.
Disturbing the Universe is playing in New York at the Cinema Village Theater and then around the country through the end of January at least. And we will post a list of where it will be playing on our website.
And there is a website for Disturbing the Universe. Pretty easy to remember.
Yes, it's disturbingtheuniverse.com.
Disturbingtheuniverse.com. Great. Well, thank you guys for writing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.